numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727 if you want to ask the pastor. Are you a pastor?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Sometimes sometimes we call it Ask the Professor. Sometimes we call it Ask the President. It really doesn't matter all that much.
There's a Rev in front of my name, so.
But there you go. Ask the Rev. Pastor Travis Scholl, he is on the staff here at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And they are having a seminar, a workshop, I guess is the word that we should use, a workshop coming up at the end of July here that Pastor Scholl is going to be a presenter at. I shouldn't end a sentence with a preposition here in a guy that's about to talk about a creative working workshop. Anyway.
I won't be grading papers at the end. So,
July 27, 28, 29, something called Faith and Creative Writing. What's the workshop about?
Well, it's the title kind of says it all. It's a creative writing workshop, so it's open to participants who can be first-time writers, just starting, proven veterans, whatever, just a time for people who are interested in the connections between faith, religion, and creative writing to come together and share each other's work, learn a little bit more, practice, and the Tuesday, the 28th, there'll be a public reading where all the participants will have an opportunity to read from their own work to the general public. So
now you're a pretty young guy, so I can tell you're not a baby boomer.
No.
You know, baby boomers ruined a lot of things. And I can say that because I'm a baby boomer. One of them is the English language. Baby boomers elevated ourselves to a very high point. And what we said was, no, we can't have rules and regulations about how English is used. We want to be able to use it any way we want, and you just have to adjust when it comes to trying to understand what we're saying.
Kind of like finishing your sentences with prepositions.
Exactly. But see, I felt guilty about it, so I got that going.
Right, right.
And one of the outcomes here has been an evolution of the English language, which in some ways is unrecognizable in speech and writing on the part of both boomers and post-boomers like yourself, almost to the point where I think it's a crisis. Am I overstating it?
Yeah, maybe a little bit. I think there's two sides to the coin. I think there is one of the beautiful things about the English language is its fluidity, or the way you know, in the history of the English language, the way it kind of has taken things from other languages and just kind of brought it all together, which is a plus and a minus. You know, if you compare it to, say, French, which is, what they call one of the Romance languages, it derives from Latin, and so most of its structure and vocab come from the Latin. English is just kind of this amalgamation of a whole lot of different things. And so that makes it a flexible language, which I think also makes it easy to abuse. So it can be frustrating. You know, in my full-time job as an editor, it can be frustrating to see how the language gets abused. And what happens is then it ends up in being bad communication. It doesn't communicate ideas very well.
So when somebody speaks well, or writes well, when they arrive at a point where they really handle the language well, is there a name for a person who has achieved that kind of status?
Ozzie Hoffman.
Okay, I wasn't looking for I was looking more for a category than a person, but yeah, I have to agree with that. How do you have a workshop? How do you have to start with the reality that people, that language is regressing, that we actually take some pride in our evolving of the language, taking a word like bad, for example, and using it in such a way that it means good.
Right.
Hey, that's a bad car. Well, we're trying to tell you it's a good car. We do things like that. And then along comes Travis Scholl in his workshop, and we're running in the opposite direction. The more we abuse it, the more we mangle it, the happier we are. What do you have to say to us to convince us maybe we ought to stop that, or do you have a different approach?
Well, I think one of the things is when language is used poorly, it makes those who know how to use language well look all that much better.
Yeah.
And
you think so?
I think so. I think, you know, it's...
Do you think rappers read good writing and are impressed by it, or they think, what in the world is this?
Well, I think it depends on the rapper to a large degree. I think there are some rappers who are kind of conscious of the tradition in which they're standing. So, you know, and to be honest, there's some, you know, in terms of the use of rhyme and rhythm, you know, there's some interesting things that are happening in like hip hop or something like that.
If you watch the news, you know, the local news, and the reporters go out and something happens, and so they inevitably they find the bystander who can reveal whatever it is that they saw. 9 times out of 10, at least, that bystander cannot speak the English language properly. They'll say something that is wrong,
mm-hmm.
grammatically. And I see this and I think to myself, good heavens, you know, we have all this public education, we have all these high schools, everybody's taking English. What's gone wrong,
mm-hmm.
Pastor?
Mm-hmm.
What happened? Are they getting A's when they don't deserve them, or I can't figure it out?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I have a real good answer to that, except that, you know, what ends up happening is it makes it a lot harder to listen and to receive the message. Kind of, you almost have to go behind the words to say, well, what really was their point, or what is it that they were really trying to say? And I think by and large, people don't really do that work, and so they end up just kind of disregarding.
So if you can't speak it well, then you probably can't write it well. If you get to a place where you do speak well, write well, now I suppose you're in a position to consider what is creative writing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's writing to survive, just to communicate some things, and then there's creative writing. In a workshop here at Concordia Seminary, we're going to talk about creative writing. What do you mean by that term?
Right. Well, it's interesting that you ask that question, because I kind of actually struggle with that term a little bit. Because on one hand, I think all writing in some way is creative, which may sound a little ironic to say, but in their own way, any writing that you do requires some level of creative thought. Even when I was in seminary writing papers that are kind of academic, dry, straightforward, just lay out the propositional ideas, yeah, you still have to come up with something that has originality, that you're not just kind of recycling somebody else's old thoughts, at least when it's successful.
Okay, but, so every piece of writing is creative in some way,
yeah,
because it has to be organized. It should be organized in some way. What are the qualities that caused Travis Scholl to, and you had a journal. You
had
the Concordia Journal here at the seminary.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess people submit things to you,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
What are the qualities that cause you to say, this is some uncreative stuff here. This is I'm not putting this in my journal.
Yeah.
And then you read this one and you say, oh, this is wonderful. This is so creative. What qualities are you looking for?
Right. Well, I think just on the level of writing, I'm looking for something that has a sense of rhythm. So it
rhythm,
so it reads well. So if the writing is poor, I keep finding myself having to stop and reread, go back to the beginning of the sentence and go, okay, they lost me somewhere in here, or it just is very slow reading. Whereas good writing, it's like you're kind of riding their wave. There's
mm-hmm.
and there's clarity to it. Right. It's clear, and you know where they're going. You can kind of, you can almost feel two steps ahead of where they're going, and you're thinking, okay, they know what they're doing, and they're using ideas in kind of faithful, creative ways.
When you're reading a submission to the Concordia Journal, and you're well into the article, and you're shaking your head, and you're saying to yourself, I can't believe that people do this because they've committed some common error, common mistake. What is that mistake? What are those top two mistakes that writers make that make you shake your head and say, what are you thinking?
Right. I think one, and I should say the journal's peer-reviewed, so I ultimately don't make any yes or no decisions. It's the faculty's journal. So just to be upfront, kind of diplomatic, that's how decisions are made. But one of my biggest pet peeves, I could tell you right now, is to use the old kind of grade school grammar, passive sentence structures. So anytime a sentence begins with, like, there is or there are, and then you have to use a passive verb in order to be able to continue the sentence, that just drives me nuts because it just sucks all the energy out of the writing. And
I can even remember that from my old English courses.
There
passive
you go.
Voice.
Yep.
Don't write in the passive voice.
Yep. And it,
so you don't,
you know,
say
in academic writing,
hit, you say I hit the ball.
Right, right. And in academic writing, and not just theology, I have my college roommate's a meteorologist at North Carolina State, and he hates the level of science writing. Just scientists are such poor writers, but it almost lends itself to passive sentence structures because it kind of makes you feel like you're being more academic in this kind of strange sort of way, because active sentence structures sound too simple when the beauty is in their simplicity.
Yeah.
So,
but that's what makes it so readable and clear.
Exactly, exactly.
So, you know, I've noticed that the creative types, the artists, you know, much like you messing with their art. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you do,
I'm that way too.
So if you write a creative piece, it's kind of difficult, I think, for a person to submit that piece into a creative writing mm-hmm. workshop and then have people. Well, I'm sure you don't just tear it to pieces there in
right.
front of everybody, Pastor Scholl, but. You know, are people going to be criticized? Are people going to be said, well, you know, you're not doing this very well and you could do this better?
Yeah. Well, I think there is, and having been in participant on the other side of the coin, just being participants in writers' workshops, you do have to, you're kind of laying things out online. So there is a level of vulnerability that you're kind of laying stuff out there. But I think, and part of the reason I'm excited about the workshop being at the seminary and being a religious workshop is that right up front, we're going to covenant with each other that, we're all people of faith. We're all Christians. And so, anything that is said in the room has to be constructive. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean there isn't going to be constructive criticism, but the criticism has to be directed towards making the piece as good as it can possibly be. And the workshops I've been in that have worked well, that spirit is shared by everybody in the room. And so, you know, and in that sense, the covenant goes both ways. If I or any of the participants are feeling like, well, that comment didn't really help, then we just call each other on it. And and I think that's a way to make people feel secure to share their work.
I'll say, if you're particularly vulnerable, if you've got a thin skin,
yep,
it might be a difficult experience.
Yeah, it might be. Yeah, but I think ultimately, if you go into it knowing that my work can be better for it, then that's the payoff. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, at lunchtime on Wednesday, July 29th, when we all break and head back to our homes, wherever they are, you can take it or leave it. You know, I mean, if, you know, I'll be sharing some of my own work, and if I feel, well, this helped, this didn't, I don't have to change a word, ultimately.
All right, so there are probably a number of creative writing workshops that a person could sign up for in a variety of settings, but this is a faith and creative writing workshop. So how does faith, other than the kindness that you already suggested is present, how does faith influence my ability to write well creatively?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked. The ultimately, where I'm coming at with this is that faith is integral to creative writing because the faith we have is in a creative God. And so in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that's, you know, our belief in the Trinity is creative in the sense that, you know, the Son is creative. I'm thinking of John 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh. And the Spirit, too. Who creates faith, as Luther would tell us? Well, the Spirit does. And so God, at the heart of our faith, is a creative God. And so I think, I know for me personally, as a quote-unquote creative writer, I feel like no matter what topic or what the subject is or what I'm actually writing, it's all an act of faith. I wouldn't be writing these things if I didn't believe in the God who has revealed himself to us.
Now, we can both agree that the Word of God is living and active, and it has a quality about it that other writing doesn't have, because it actually has embedded in it, if I can say it that way, eternal life, the stuff of eternity. I don't want to talk about that. Set that aside for a second. As a creative writer, as an editor of a journal, when you read the scriptures in English, do you say to yourself, this is pretty much an average, kind of a normal narrative, or do you say to yourself, oh my goodness, this is such creative stuff, apart from the inspirational component?
Right. No, I think that's part of the reason, as a Christian, too. I am constantly amazed at how great the Bible is, strictly as a piece of literature.
Why?
The story that is encapsulated within scripture, as a literary person, I am convinced the Book of Psalms is the greatest collection of poetry Western literature has ever produced. I'm consistently amazed at the artistry of the Gospel of Mark. I mean, how Mark is able in 16 short chapters. I mean, you can read the Gospel of Mark in probably, maybe an hour and a half, cover to cover. But it is just so packed with energy and Jesus just kind of constantly on the move. It's just an amazing piece of literature. And I think that goes all the way through Genesis, these great stories of how God first begins to act within humanity, how he calls Abraham, how the story of Joseph, oh my gosh, you know, the coat of many colors to the bottom of a deep well to second in command in Egypt. And then that terrific couple of chapters where the brothers come back and don't see who he is, and he has to hide his face because he's crying. And then they go and get Benjamin and bring him back. And then Joseph sees Benjamin, can't hold it in anymore, and so he takes off his disguise and says, it's me. You thought I was dead. I'm alive again. Just the drama of that is so powerful.
When people leave your Faith and Creative Writing Workshop here at Concordia Seminary, July 27, 28, and 29, when noontime rolls around on the 29th, in your experience as a writer and a person who has attended these workshops, what are they likely to be taking with them that will cause them on the way home to say, man, I am glad that I took this workshop?
Right, right. Well, I hope in some small way that they're better writers, that they, through the experience of sharing their writings with others, and then also seeing other people's writing, no matter what kind of writing it is, if it's poetry, if it's narrative, if it's nonfiction, that in that experience, that kind of interaction with other writers, I guess, let me use a metaphor. There's some cross-fertilization that happens, that their own kind of seeds are cross-fertilized with other seeds to create more, to germinate in new work. But I think also the takeaway is that they're inspired in some way, that it is an experience of faith, that the talking with each other, that the sharing with each other is also a religious experience, that they feel inspired in the religious sense by it.
So you have some introspection, some self-criticism, some self-evaluation as people listen to what is being said and think about applying that to their own writing. You have some, as you say, cross-fertilization where people are evaluating each other, hopefully in a godly way. How often does it happen where you got somebody who is in the workshop and it becomes pretty clear to you that they are quite self-impressed? They really think that they have achieved a level of excellence in writing, and you're thinking to yourself, no, you're not anywhere near that level. You actually have quite a long way to go. Does that happen often?
Yeah, I think really, in some sense, every writer has to kind of always be looking in the mirror. I think there's been times.
See, that's the problem. The person I'm describing looks in the mirror and says, what a fine boy am I,
right,
when it comes
right.
to my writing, anyway.
Yep. Well, I think there are careful, gentle, well, maybe not so gentle, considerate, let me use that word, considerate ways to burst bubbles.
well
you,
put.
You just wait for the right opportunity to provide your constructive criticism and do it in a pointed enough way that they get the picture. But I know even for me, that's happened to me, where when I was in college, I took a writing course with Walt Wongren, and there were a couple of times we had one-on-one meetings in his office where he kind of had to lay down the law, and I'm grateful for it in the end. I used to joke I'd come out of his office smoking a little bit, but I was better for it in the end.
Crispy critters.
Right.
All right, so the Faith and Creative Writing Workshop, including presenter Travis Scholl, Pastor Travis Scholl, with whom we're talking today, will be July 27, 28, and 29. What kind of days are those?
That's a Monday through Wednesday.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And it's kind of a 2.5-day kind of a thing, right?
Yeah, it'll actually start at 1 on Monday to give people time to travel.
Does it have a cost?
Yes, although I'm really sorry. You'll contact the continuing education office
okay.
for that.
I've got it here.
Okay.
We can look it up during the break here and figure that out. Registration fee, $125.
There
needs
we go.
To be in by July 6th.
Yep.
God's blessings on that.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
AMA 50 KFUO celebrating 85 years of proclaiming the gospel and touching lives.
This is Clarence Roth from Bella Fountain Neighbors, Missouri. Yes, for memories of KFUO, while attending grade school at St. Jacoby Lutheran School in Jennings, Missouri, in the 1930s, we would go on certain days to KFUO and sing. We children enjoyed singing live on the radio. Thank you.
Do you have a story about how AM850 KFUO touched your life? Call the memory line and record your message. 1-800-737-0172. The AM850 KFUO memory line. That's 1-800-737-0172.
more evidence of the Great Flood. Hear more about it next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
If there was a great worldwide flood, as described in Genesis, such a catastrophe certainly should have left obvious evidences of itself all over the world. Scientists who believe in creation say that we are surrounded by these evidences. Many of them also believe that some of the features associated with glaciers can be better explained by a catastrophic flood. While evolutionary scientists scoff at the biblical account of the flood, they continue to run across evidences of what they take to be huge floods. Now further evidence has been reported of a continental flood. The September 1989 issue of Geology, a scientific professional journal, carried an article about drumlins in northern Saskatchewan. Drumlins are hills that are traditionally associated with glacial activity. When viewed from the air, they resemble eggs lying on their sides, all pointing in the same direction. Over the last few years, some scientists have proposed that drumlins were formed by large quantities of water running in the same direction. The article in Geology offers yet more evidence for large quantities of water moving over the continental land surfaces. One of the scientists remarked that there's nothing in recorded history that matches the size of these floods. Well, if we consider Genesis to be recorded history rather than ancient and ignorant myth, there certainly is an historical record of a huge flood.
For a printed transcript of today's program, visit our website at creationmoments.com. Or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
On the next Joy, we'll tell you about a leading American composer who, though he couldn't read music, was attracted to the pretty sopranos in the college choir and somehow signed up. And on the very first day, he was confronted, all right, by Mozart. This is Ron Clem, the story of inspiration's strange path, this week on Joy. Listen for Joy on the web at KFUO.org and Sunday afternoons at 4:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
You used to nurse me.
Change my diapers.
Take care of me 24 hours a day.
Mom.
Dad.
I need you.
There's all these things I'm feeling that I never felt before.
I need to know about sex,
love.
Values.
I need you to tell me what you think.
I need you to tell me where you stand.
Help me make the right choices.
Mom, Dad, talk with me. You always say I'm still your little girl.
A message from the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services.
Our guest is Pastor Travis Scholl. He is editor. What's your title?
Managing editor of theological publications. How about that? That's a 10 cent.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
They paying you on that level, that title?
Yes.
All right.
Hey, I have a job.
Anything about the hesitation.
I'm holding a call and I have a job.
I understand. All right, I want to talk to you about something else here, see if I can tap some of your expertise in another way. There's a we get press releases here all the time. People want to promote their books on our radio shows, and about 9 out of 10 of them we don't have anything to do with.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, I guess we could say it this way, that you know, they don't rightly divide law and gospel for the most time. But I got a kick out of this, and I wanted to check this with you. This is a press release, and the headline, the title on this is Gossip is in Our Genes. Did you know that? I'm not talking about your Levi's there, Pastor.
Right.
It says that there's a new book out that explains how gossip got us through the Stone Age and helps us today. Are you ready?
I don't know if I am.
The author says, and by the way, he's a medical doctor and a so-called expert on evolutionary medicine, author of a new book. He says, gossip has been around since the first caveman overslept in a neighbor's bed of branches. Didn't that just kind of make one eyebrow go up? He says, that's because gossip is vital to our survival. He explains, we all need to know whom we can trust, whom we can count on in the long run, and whom we should never turn our backs on. Gossip is a great tool for conveying that information. Are you still with me? I know
halfway.
You're not shaking your head yet. Gossip even helped our species play the mating game successfully. He says gossip often concerns cheating or rating a person on attractiveness and trustworthiness, essentially how good a mate he or she would be, says the author. And far from being idle, it actually helped us survive when our food didn't come from the local supermarket and rival bands threatened to raid our camp at night. Our ancestors needed to know who would stand and fight and who would cut and run when the going got tough. You want to buy this book, Pastor?
I think I'll pass.
And what is it about the promotion of the book so far that has not sold you on the book?
Well, I guess my initial thought was, if that's right, I need to watch more soap operas.
You don't watch soap operas, Pastor?
Not too consistently, many? No.
A couple of questions here. This is, in my view, I just show my cards here. It's so convoluted that I can't quite figure out where to start. Why would anybody want to come to the conclusion that gossip is somehow linked to our DNA, that it's in our genes, so to speak? We seem to have this propensity these days to take a number of different bad behaviors and sort of explain them away by saying, it's not our fault, it's in our genes.
Right.
And now we bring gossip onto the table. What do you think?
Well, I think one of the things that is in our genes is exactly what you're saying. We always want to find excuses for bad behavior. So in that sense, I don't think it's any different than it's ever been for human beings to look for reasons to be able to do what we call sin and do it without having to feel guilty about it. So that would be my reading between the lines. I think probably on another level, he just wants to sell books.
Well, the way this is described here in the first couple of paragraphs, he makes it sound like it's kind of an exchange of information.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he's trying to rework the definition of gossip, but
right.
But when you use the term gossip, what do you mean by that term?
Well, yeah, and that is kind of what is kind of weird about what he's saying, because often, and this is true in my own experience, gossip is conveying bad information about people. So it's not reliable information that would help me survive in any way, to kind of use his language. So yeah, I think he is operating with a strange definition
of what
gospel is.
Now, what do you mean by bad information? Do you mean false information?
Yeah, false lies. That oftentimes, and, you know, why do we gossip? I think if we're really honest with ourselves, it's for deceitful means that we want to talk bad of someone else to gain position for ourselves.
Now, some of us feel liberated to tell bad things about each other,
mm-hmm,
if we're in personal knowledge that they're true.
Mm-hmm.
If I find out something about you that you actually got a D on an English paper sometime in your writing career, and I tell somebody, well, I'll tell you what, that Travis Scholl, you know, he got a D in English one time. But it's a fact.
Yep. Yeah, true.
Is that gossip?
Yeah, it would be. Although I think maybe the better way to say it is, I think gossip often is effective because it's taking facts out of context. So, you know, when I am telling somebody an honest-to-God fact about somebody else, but gossiping about it, I'm taking it out of any sort of context that would help it make more sense to the person I'm telling it to. You know, so let's say I got a D on an English paper in fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been that I had the flu that day and wasn't able to finish the project with the kind of success that I'd like to, you know. But if I'm gossiping, I'll withhold that information and just give you the stuff that's the juicy part. And so it's that kind of taking out of context that really can make it harmful.
So, let's go to the small catechism here for a moment, because it seems to me that maybe there's something involved here to talk about the eighth commandment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. Well, that might be the gossip realm. And the question in the catechism is, what does this mean? And the answer is, we should fear and love God so that we do not tell lies about our neighbor. That's obvious. But then it goes on. Betray him.
Mm-hmm.
Slander him. Hurt his reputation. But we should defend him, speak well of him, and explain everything in the kindest possible mm-hmm. way. It seems to me that I don't know what the dictionary definition of gossip is, but gossip is usually information that is shared in such a way that it undermines somebody else's credibility or reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's designed to bring somebody a little bit lower than I am, or designed to elevate me a little bit higher than they are, that's kind of the way I see gossip.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's exactly right.
Would you agree? And
it's an
Eighth Commandment issue?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I think at the heart of it, there's a self-centeredness to gossip that, like you said, either I'm trying to push the other person down or I'm trying to elevate myself in such a way that's really all about me.
So if you had a chance to sit down with this author, And I realize, I know you're going to give a disclaimer here. First of all, you don't know the guy. You haven't read the book. You're not sure exactly what, the premises are. I know that. But he's advancing a book that excuses gossip because it's just part of our DNA. What would you say to the guy?
Well, in one sense, this is going to sound, I think he's trying to obviously kind of excuse the sin. But in another sense, as a Christian who takes seriously the fact that we are born in sin, I'm not so sure it isn't in our DNA. I don't think that's the way he means it. But I think that'd be a question I'd have to say, perhaps it is in our DNA in the way that we are born as broken, sinful creatures. There's no escaping it. The problem is then embracing it as the way it's supposed to be. And that's probably where I'd really want to ask him, just, and obviously not knowing what kind of religious background he has, does he really think as a moral question, gossip is a good thing? Because it's so destructive.
The promotional piece says, even though it's moved from the watering hole to the water cooler at work, gossip still serves the same ends. Today we gossip about who's on top, who's got the boss's ear, who's going to be fired, and who's in for a raise. All important subjects for our survival. The author also explains why we are so interested in celebrities and how we benefit from gossiping about them. While some of us may feel guilty about it, none of us can always resist the urge to gossip or to sneak a peek at the latest tabloid story on Brad and Angelina.
Mm-hmm.
The author's advice, enjoy in moderate doses, know that it's in your genes, and pass along the latest dish about Britney.
Right.
What do you think about his advice?
Well, when you're standing at the water cooler, and I think in these times, it's especially true. There's some comfort in gossip that, if a layoff is pending and you're wondering about how secure your job is, there's a comfort in being able to gossip about somebody else or, I think their job is on the line.
So you're saying that gossip is a good thing?
No, anxiety
is concerned?
No, I'll finish. I think... I think that's a false comfort because, the old cliche goes, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. If that's the game you're going to choose to play when you're standing around the water cooler, it's inevitably going to come back around and bite you in the keister. So ultimately, any comfort it gives us is a false comfort because in the end, when decisions are made about anxious things, usually it isn't the gossip that wins the day. Unfortunately, we do live in a broken world, and sometimes gossip is extremely harmful and destructive to people's lives, and that's the real tragedy.
So are you saying that a little gossip, I mean, you talked about the sinful human nature, so we're gonna gossip, just like he says here, while some of us may feel guilty about it, none of us can always resist the urge to gossip. Are you going to say that a little gossip is probably normal and just part of the human condition, don't worry too much about it? Or are you going to say, if you identified gossip, then you need to repent of it and you need to...
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's exactly it. The proper response to gossip when I give it, I guess part of where I'm coming from is I'm a realist. And so it is inevitable that I'll get caught in the temptation of gossiping about somebody else. And the proper response to that is to go to God and say, I'm sorry. Please forgive me.
Well, I don't know if they've got a water cooler down there at Concordia Seminary where the faculty and the staff gather every once in a while, but everybody gathers around the water cooler sometime sooner or later, and that does not necessarily mean that they're all going to gossip. And if there's something going on here at the seminary, if there's a workshop coming up here or something, and somebody says, well, can you believe that they didn't invite that Chuck Rather to the...
He's a good writer.
You know, I can tell you for sure that that makes all the sense in the world, that I shouldn't be the presenter at the creative writing workshop. And I don't think that person has gossiped.
Right.
So how do you separate evaluation and
right.
assessment and even preference?
Right. Well, I would say a couple of things. I think the first sign that perhaps you're not gossiping, but you're toeing the line, is when two people are standing at the water cooler and they're talking about a third person who isn't there. I think that's the first sign that at least the possibility of gossip is opening its door. I think the second part of that is motive. Which is a squirrely thing. I mean, it's hard to judge people's motives without gossiping about it. But to ask myself when I'm saying something, or to ask when I'm hearing something, what's really the motivation behind why they're telling me this? Is their interest genuine and in the best interest? Well, ask Luther's question. Is this putting the best construction on the situation, no matter what it is? And I think if you're able to kind of go through both of those tests and be able to say the best construction is being put on this situation, then that's a pretty clear indication that it's a good conversation to be a part of. Because, you know, like you say, I mean, not all water cooler conversations are gossip just because you're having them at the water cooler and you're talking about things that are, for lack of a better word, kind of juicy, you know.
I don't know what evolutionary medicine is. This guy is identified as an expert on evolutionary medicine. He is identified as a board-certified internist and one of the nation's leading practitioners of evolutionary medicine, whatever that is.
Yeah.
But it's suspect in my thinking. If a person doesn't believe in Darwinian evolution, and I assume that's what we're talking about
yeah.
here, then that suggests to me that this board-certified internist is somehow drawing conclusions based on some kind of evolutionary model that he has imported into his medical
right,
practice.
Right.
Doesn't
yeah.
that all sound a little, I like your term, squirrely?
Yeah, I think so. My wife, Jenny, is a pediatric nurse practitioner, and I don't think she practices evolutionary medicine, but she is really good at the medicine she practices, so
well,
I'll stick with that kind of medicine.
Maybe you can check with her and find out what evolutionary medicine is. And
yeah, I'll get back to you. Yeah, I'll get back to you on that.
But it does seem that one of the outcomes of the importing of the theory of evolution into the otherwise scientific practice of medicine is that you somehow come to a conclusion that DNA is responsible for gossip.
Right.
And I think that, I'll just be honest with you, I think that's nuts.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy is an expert. He's a board-certified internist, and I'm just a weaselly radio host. Who am I to say that this guy's nuts? So I appeal to your higher intellect and position in life. Do you think he's nuts?
It sounds like it to me. The book sounds
nuts. I feel so much better.
Yeah.
The book sounds strange, but at the end of the day, let's just project you into a parish pastoral situation. And you've got quite the gossiper in your congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And he is really stirring up the pot and making a lot of trouble, and it's come to your attention, and you're probably going to have to confront it. Now, I realize I'm making up what is probably a ridiculous hypothesis here, but...
Oh, completely ridiculous.
Work with me on this. So you say, you know, Chuck, I need to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
I got some issues that we need to discuss. Okay, sure, Pastor. So we have a conversation. And you confront me on my gossiping. And I say, au contraire, Pastor Scholl. I have a book here by this fine author who says, encourages me to engage in my gossip moderately. A little gossip never hurt anybody. And you say what?
Well, I think I really love what Luther says in the Small Catechism about the Eighth Commandment. And I think it is very convicting to go through my daily interactions with people and ask me the questions Luther wants me to ask. Am I speaking kindly? Am I harming this person's reputation? And those are ultimately questions that really get into the heart of what it means to be a human being, to be a baptized child of God, and to live in a community of other people. So, you know, the question that I would pose to him is, do you really want to blame this on your DNA? Or do you really want to be a part of a community in which we love and care and support one another? And hope that the law does its work in his heart. To convict him of his sin. You know, in the end, I have no idea what's in my DNA. But what I do know is that the hurt and the harm and the destructiveness that gossip does within a community of people who at least say they love each other. And that, to me, is where the reality of gossip lies. I can say it's in my DNA, you know, every day of the week and twice on Sundays. That does not negate the fact that when I have gossiped against someone else, I have done them harm. And they are worse people for it. And so am I.
You don't have to work too hard to think back, certainly in recent times, during the sexual revolution, where folks began to sleep around, you know, cheat on their spouses, and then say things like, hey, it's not my fault, you know, this is just who I am.
Right,
these are the feelings I have, and God made me this way. And then I think the homosexual community said, well, wait a minute. You know, if the heterosexuals are going to do whatever they want, then who are they to tell us, or who is anybody to tell us that, you know, we can't do practice what we want to practice? And, you know, they said, well, God made me this way, and it's not my fault, and God wants me to be happy, and so I'm going to do what I'm going to do. Now I got a guy who's saying, it's not your fault. God made you this way. It's in your DNA, and your gossiping is not really a sin. It could be.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that's, you know, exceeds moderation could be, but no, it's not a sin. Is somebody in the church one of these days going to stand up and say, that'll be about enough of that?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't. If somebody's saying it somewhere, I'm not hearing it. Are you
right,
hearing it?
Right. Well, I think Well, there's a lot of voices saying a lot of different things.
Can you do a creative writing piece on this theme?
I think I would like to think most Sunday mornings when the pastor gets up into the pulpit or the wherever it is that they preach, that they're speaking to those issues in some way and calling a spade a spade. Unfortunately, those voices don't necessarily get broadcast to huge audiences. But, in the end, and of course, you have to be sitting in that congregation to hear that word.
That's what I was first thinking in my mind.
But,
and you have to be awake when the sermon comes around.
Right, yeah. But, you know, in a sense, that's what we're doing right here, right now. And trying to, I guess I take comfort in the fact that sometimes God speaks in small, still whispers. And sometimes we have to be content with that.
I'm a little bit nervous. Should I be nervous? I'm a little bit nervous that somewhere there's somebody engaging in heterosexual sin or homosexual sin or cooking the books at work or just gossiping like crazy, but considering it to be moderate thanks to the good doctor's book here. And it's going to lead to a bad eternal outcome. Mm-hmm. They're on the path to a bad eternal outcome. And they say, hey, it's not my fault. God made me this way. And we Christians say, well, okay.
Right. Well, I think that's why, you know, we're in the season of Pentecost. And it is the Spirit's work in our heart to help us to give good witness to our faith. I think that means sometimes we say things people don't want to hear. And so in a sense, we have to pray for courage to know, not only to know the right time to be able to speak the truth to people, but also to have, again, going back to creative writing, to have the right words to say that that can get at the heart of the issue with people in their lives, and do it in such a way that it leaves, you know, it's ultimately God's work to change people's hearts, so that I give a witness that leaves the openness for God to do what God does.
Pastor Travis Scholl, thank you, sir, for coming in today, spending a little time with us.
My pleasure.
He is a presenter at the upcoming Faith and Creative Writing Workshop, which will be here at Concordia Seminary on July 27th, 28th, and 29th. If you are interested, like more information, you can call the seminary here, 314-505-7486. Let's tell them you want some information about the Faith and Creative Writing Workshop. God bless you, sir.
Thank you. You too, Chip.
Listen to Chuck Rather and guests Monday through Friday at the same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of The Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.